Yeah, this is all crazy. I mean, this is not what's going to happen, and you know, the public is getting hoodwinked by people, extremists.
That's a good subtitle for the book, maybe. The public is getting hoodwinked. That's good.
Well, that could, a lot of books could go under that heading.
Yeah.
Not only is it an exciting time, but I think that many years from now, this era that we're living through right now will be seen as the golden era.
This is Brain Inspired.
Welcome. This is Paul Middlebrooks. All right, well, I have now made it possible for you to support the podcast, should you choose. I created a Patreon account, which you can access through the website, braininspired.co, or go directly to the Patreon page, and that's at patreon.com/braininspired. And I got my first supporter, the man who actually strong-armed me into making this Patreon page, Alex. Thank you. So you can support the show at two levels for now, either $2 or $4 per month. That works out to 50 cents or $1 per episode. I don't have any gifts or special offers for you at this time, but if you decide to support the show, I will be able to share things exclusively with you when they become available. Maybe some toy code to play with, or if I write a book or want to release some bonus or special footage and material. Whatever the case, people who support the show on Patreon will be the first to get that special stuff for free or at a discount, etc. Plus, my wife will no longer be able to say, "I bring home no bacon." Okay. Enough of that. The voice you heard at the beginning was indeed the Terence Sainofsky. Yes, that one. I was flattered such a legend would agree to come on the show, so we all got lucky here. Terry has written a book called The Deep Learning Revolution. To say it's an insider's view is a major understatement. So Terry was one of a handful of people who basically created AI as we know it today. Since then, the man has never stopped putting out great work in both neuroscience and artificial intelligence. So we talk about his book, which I'm waiting for in my mailbox any day now, and our chat made me even more excited to get my hands on the book. We also talk about his online Coursera course with Barbara Oakley called Learning How to Learn, and it's the most popular online course ever. Okay, you'll hear I try to trip him up. And I ask him about his first published paper. This was in the world of astrophysics, his first love. And it was published in 1969. And he immediately launches into a summary of the work like he had just released it yesterday. It's amazing. So I had so much left I didn't get to ask Terry because of time constraint. Really so much. So apologies for that. But I think you'll still enjoy and get a lot out of our chat. Lastly, Terry was an early influence on me. Like his book, The Computational Brain, with Patricia Churchland, literally helped alter my life path. And I tell him as much right at the beginning. And guess what I do? I flub the name of the book. So you'll get to hear that. Really ridiculous. I seriously considered editing that out and splicing in a correction, but I decided to leave in the embarrassing moment, so hope you enjoy hearing my heart jump out of my chest there in a few seconds. But Terry was gracious, and he let me live, and we had a great conversation. A link to his book and all the other stuff that we talk about can be found in the show notes at braininspired.co/podcast/15. Please enjoy Terence Sainofsky. I have a distinct memory I'd like to share. So 20 years ago, I was in an undergraduate at UT Austin, University of Texas, and I was in aerospace engineering major. And that day I had gone to Half Price Books and picked up a couple books and gone to the laundromat. And this, I distinctly remember the dim yellowish lights of the laundry. And I read this book while my laundry was being done. And the book was called Computational Neuroscience by Patricia Churchland and Terence Sanofsky.
Actually, it was the computational brain, but thank you anyway.
The computational brain. Yeah, that's right. How can I mess that up? The computational brain. And so that was 28 years ago. And it's actually recently celebrated its 25th anniversary. So congratulations. So that book, reading that book that day, actually changed the course of my path toward neuroscience. So I just want to say thank you, Terry, and welcome to the podcast.
Wonderful to be here. And also, thank you for remembering the book, because 25 years is a long time. But in fact, there's seeds of the current book that is coming out next week is really contained in that first book. It was all about populations of neurons and how the early work that was being done by the neural network community with learning algorithms was giving us the ability to create distributed representations in populations of neurons, very small at the time, like little toy problems. But it was already clear back then that this was a kind of computing that the brain very much looked like the kind of computing the brain could be doing.
Yeah, it was a great book, and it really did change my path. So I don't really need to introduce you, but just by way of a few tidbits here. So your thesis advisor was John Hopfield of the famed Hopfield Network. That helped usher in neural networks from the very beginning. And among a billion other things that you've done, you co-invented the Boltzmann machine with Jeff Hinton, which is one of the earliest actually useful neural networks. And your early work helped drive the transition from the good old-fashioned type AI, the symbol-based AI, to the modern statistical data-driven approach that underlies all of the modern current successes of the deep learning networks. You've published over 500 papers and written 12 books, and now you're Francis Crick Professor at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies. So you've done so much, and there are so many different directions that we could go. If you'll allow me to, I'd like to start in 1969, though, in the Astrophysical Journal, with a paper titled A Theoretical Analysis of Methods of Interpreting Radio Line Data for H2 Regions. This was the first paper on your CV. You remember the gist of that paper and the conclusions drawn?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. this is the bringing back memories. This is as I was really just getting started in science. I had spent a summer at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory working with an astrophysicist, Robert Gelming. And with the problem that we worked on was these are lines from H2 regions. These are hot balls of gas, and there's something called the B sub n problem, which is transitions between very high lying states of hydrogen, like between 109 and 110. Normally, we think of the lines, you know, that you see in the visible coming from, you know, the transitions from, you know, the lower orbitals, but when you're up there at 109, it's in the radio region, and you can see them in radio telescopes. So that actually was the beginning of my interest in astrophysics. And in fact, you mentioned that John was my PhD advisor at Princeton. But in fact, my master's degree was with John Wheeler, who black hole fame and general relativity. And that's really when I first went to Princeton, you know, this is before any neural networks or the brain or anything.
Right.
It really was to my path was set. I was going to work with John Wheeler. And, you know, of course, no one can predict where one's career is going. But here I am.
Yeah, right. Well, I didn't predict 20 years ago when I was reading your book that I'd be interviewing you on a podcast, you know, or that podcast would exist. So this is nice for me.
Right.
Okay, so I want to get to your new book in just a second that's coming out. First, I just want to talk briefly about your online course and the book Learning How to Learn. So this is a Coursera course, the full title of which is Learning How to Learn, Powerful Mental Tools to Help You Master Tough Subjects. And you do the course with Barbara Oakley, and it's now the most popular massive online open course to date, which is awesome. I took it. It's great, and it's accessible for everyone. And really what it does, it talks about the neuroscience, about behind how we learn and how to use what we know about neuroscience to learn more effectively. Where did the idea come from to make this course, and how did you connect with Barbara Oakley to do it?
Well, that's a really a wonderful story. The background is that I've been a co-director for 10 years of a science of learning center sponsored by the NSF at UCSD, my sister institution. My lab's at the Salk, but I'm actually on the faculty also at the University of California in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And part of the science of learning center is to try to bring, you know, our understanding of, you know, how the brain develops, you know, how language emerges, and there are six centers, each looking at a different aspect of education and the brain. And ours was the one that really focused more on learning mechanisms. You know, what do we know about how the hippocampus mm-hmm. is engaged when we're learning something, a new fact about the world? And the other thing that we tried to do was to interface with schools. So we worked very closely with the Price School on campus as a charter school. And our experience was that we were very excited about the science. We wanted to bring them into the classroom, but it turned out to be incredibly difficult, even, you know, with a school on campus. And the reason is that there's a tremendous amount of barriers that if you try to go into a school, you have to get permissions from all sorts of people. Fortunately, you know, the principal, Doris Alvarez of the Price School, was very open. But if you go to a high school, you know, in the inner city, forget it. You know, they for them, it's just another complication. Hmm. But what's worse, if you have the best solution to education, there are 12,000 school districts in the U.S. So you'd have to knock on 12,000 doors. So immediately you realize it doesn't scale. What we're trying to do doesn't scale. You know, it might work in one classroom, but how do you go from that to, you know, hundreds of thousands of classrooms? So here I was, and this is completely fortuitous. I was at a meeting that was taking place at the UC Irvine up the road, mm-hmm. and it was sponsored by the National Academy of Sciences. It's a National Academy Keck Futures Initiative, NACFI, that I actually helped to organize. And one of the speakers that I introduced was Barbara, and she was telling us the story of her life. It's fascinating. She's a remarkable woman. As she put it, she, you know, was flunked her way through math in high school. She really wasn't very good at it.
This is chronicled in her book Mind Shift as well, right?
That's right. Yep. And that's right. So there's another book and another MOOC that came afterwards, and that's a follow up. But what I came away understanding from her presentation is that after going off and learning Russian and having adventures, you know, in the Arctic, fishing trawlers and in the army, she really wanted to try to master math, and she figured out how to do it. I mean, on her own, and she went back and not just master of math, but got a PhD in electrical engineering and is now a professor of electrical engineering at Oakland University in Michigan. So, you know, what a career trajectory. Wow. Talk about, you know, being able to, you know, confront something that had been bothering her, you know, her whole life and actually making a career out of it. So in any case, I was so impressed. I had dinner with her and we hit it off. I invited her to come give a talk at our Science of Learning Center, which she did. She came and flew in. And we thought it would be a great opportunity to invite not just the faculty, but high school teachers and students. And so we had a big auditorium filled with, you know, people of all ages and backgrounds. And she was mesmerizing, unbelievable. It was clear that she, you know, had this talent for engaging the audience. And she did things that I would have never even thought of doing. For example, to reach the high school students, she used metaphors like zombies. And it turns out, I didn't notice that zombies are really big in high school these days. And she said, you know, if you're having trouble with trying to understand something, you have this mental block, don't beat your head against the wall over and over again. Don't be a zombie. Uh-huh. That's what zombies do. Get up, walk around, do something else. Just free your mind up. And your subconscious is going to work on it. And you come back to it a half hour later and it'll be much clearer. In any case, what became clear to me was that she was intuitive in terms of her understanding of the learning process. She was very good at communicating. And what was missing was a scientific understanding of the mechanisms underlying her experiences and the practical advice that she was giving to the students. It was all good, but she couldn't explain to them why it was good.
I see.
So, you know, over the period of the next 6 months or so, we put together this MOOC. And now here's another remarkable thing about Barbara. If you go online, there are like 10,000 MOOCs now, and the typical MOOC is a talking head. And this is a professor who has been giving the same course for the last 10 years.
Right.
And they're an automatic pilot, and they're just basically parroting. And it could be a very good lecture, and there's nothing wrong with the material or anything. It's just that it really is soporific. I mean, it doesn't grab your attention. And in fact, much less so than if it was a classroom, because in a classroom, at least the person is walking around and they have the opportunity to interact with the audience and with the students in the classroom. But if you're doing a MOOC, it's like talking into a vacuum. You don't have any feedback. It's very difficult. It's actually much more difficult than giving a classroom lecture, in my experience. For example, I was taping one of my MOOCs, and I launched with this joke that I thought would be, in a regular lecture, get some reaction.
Yeah.
Dead silence.
Yeah.
And you have no idea how frightening that is, because you have no idea, did they get the joke? Should I go on in the same direction? You know, what's going on here? So that's the problem. Okay. So here's what Barbara did, which is really remarkable. She realized that and we were aiming at high school students, by the way, who are the people who are really in the business of learning, right? They go to work every day to learn. She realized that we needed to engage them using all the tools that are available for animating, concepts, the metaphors. And she did something which really was brilliant. It's called green screen, and it's what weathermen use, right? When they're pointing to the hurricane in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a green screen behind them, and it's being projected electronically into the audience, and that means you can put anything up. You can put animations up. You can put pictures, movies, anything you want. And so that's what she did. She did it in her basement.
Oh wow!
Her husband was her film editor. You know, she bought a camera, high res camera. She bought a software to do some video editing. And she was the one who did all of the cuts and the animations and everything that you saw on that MOOC, Learning How to Learn.
Yeah.
Was done in her basement for $6,000.
Oh, I had no idea.
And so what you realize, again, intuitively, is that motion really captures your attention. We injected humor, and that is incredibly important for emotional engagement, right? You need to get people to laugh. You need to get people to be interested in terms of their, not just what they're thinking, but what they're feeling. She was a master at that. And I think that those are all the reasons. We don't know for sure, but, I think it really helped to help to get an audience that not only, I think, benefited, but actually was a super enthusiastic. I get fan mail every day.
But you said that you guys created the course aimed at sort of teens, but the majority of your audience has been professional adults, correct?
That's the shock, okay? And this is true not just of our MOOC. It turns out to be all MOOCs. We, of the 3 million learners, only 1% were from that target audience below 19.
Yeah.
The biggest demographic was 25 to 35.
Mm-hmm.
And half of them are college educated. So we're talking about a group that is in the workforce, they've left school, they probably have families and mortgages, but they're discovering that they need new skills in order to be able to do their job, because, you know, the day you graduate, basically what you've learned is obsolete, because, what's going on right now is moving so quickly that the schools just can't keep up with it.
Mm-hmm.
And but the beauty of the MOOC is that it allows you to do that on your own time. You don't have to go back to school. You don't have to interrupt your life. You can take whatever course you need for whatever skill you need. So it's a perfect thing. So the MOOCs really aren't a replacement for schools. They're basically, I think, are going to evolve into a lifelong learning delivery system so that, people can continue to learn for their entire life as they need new skills. So that's right. So we failed to reach the audience we were aiming at. And then, someone pointed out the obvious to us. Look, these poor students they spent all day in classrooms learning. And what you want them to do is to take another course.
Right.
That's the last thing they want to do, at night. Come on, I mean, these schools, they're doing homework. They've got a life, and so we realized that this was the wrong way to go about it. And so we actually created a whole new MOOC that is in conjunction with the University of Arizona that's going to go online very soon.
Is it zombie free?
It is. No, there are zombies, but it's filled with metaphors.
Oh, I mean, okay.
We made a huge effort to really create a metaphorical world that they could understand things on their own terms. And we actually wrote a book that just came out in August, Learning How to Learn, mm-hmm. For kids. And it's already a bestseller on Amazon. And it's aimed at the high school 12 to 14, by the way, middle school. That's the key age at which a lot of students are turned away by math because they hit algebra, basically. So we really wanted to help those students, and we're going to do it through the teachers. So the idea is that the teachers have this text that the students can read because it's written for them. And we added another author who is a writer for children's books, which is a special talent I don't have, which what words you're going to use and how you pitch things. And we have a very, very talented artist who drew cartoons for us to make it, come alive. So this book is I think, are going to be, I hope, our entrance to that age group.
Great. Well, so aside from all the techniques that you guys have, developed and communicate in the course, what is your secret to accomplishing so much? I mean, do you have like a favorite productivity tool or strategy that you'd recommend to people?
Well, it helps to have I have a big lab.
Yeah.
And I have a fantastic lab manager. And I really depend a lot. I expect a lot from people in my lab, and they are tremendously supportive of me. Right. Mm. You can't do it all that on your own. I could never have done this MOOC without Barbara. Right.
Right.
I'm also the president of the NIPS Foundation, Neural Information Processing Systems.
Yeah.
Last year in Long Beach, we had 8,000 people. I couldn't have run that meeting on my own, but my Mary Ellen Perry, my lab manager, who is very capable and really works very closely with me and with the sponsors and the academics and we really have a team. That's the secret, is to have a really first-rate team for every project, and it's not just practical projects, but it's also for scientific projects. And so a lot of the research that we do in the lab is really working with people from different backgrounds. And that's important too, by the way. Everyone lives in a silo. If you're in a physicist in a physics department, you're in a silo.
Right.
But, where the excitement is these days isn't in the silos, although, some nice things are happening in physics, there's no doubt. But if you really want to have a breakthrough sort of advances, then you need to bring together people who have different backgrounds, people from mathematics, cognitive science, bioengineering, neuroscience. And my the graduate students and postdocs, they come from all those backgrounds. So it's fantastic. It's like having a little university. And we discuss things, and everybody has a different perspective. And that's how you make the breakthroughs, is that you get that synergy between the different people that have very different backgrounds.
Radical collaboration. That's good. Okay, so your book, your new book, which it's been a long time since you've written a book by yourself, speaking of getting things
right.
done. And so this, the book's called The Deep Learning Revolution. Actually, by the time this podcast airs, I should have gotten my copy because I had pre-ordered it on Amazon. And I think the 23rd of October is when it's supposed to ship.
That is the date, and it's actually in the warehouse already, so I have an advanced copy. So it's a beautiful book. I mean, you'll be pleased. I was incredibly just proud to hold it. I mean, it's just such a beautiful object, full color.
Oh, yeah.
And it really, the paper is really, it has a good feel to it. The art, you know, they did a great design job. MIT Press is fantastic. I have worked with them for, you know, over 30 years, and I've always been happy with their product. They're very, very good. But the book itself was a reaction starting, you know, a couple of years ago when, as you know, this deep learning hit the public press.
Yeah.
And I said, wait a second now, this is just renaming something that I'd been doing since the 1980s, right?
Right.
These learning algorithms, all the learning algorithms that are being used today, were first pioneered by, you mentioned the Bolzano machine. Jeff Hinton and I worked on that back in 1983, right? And backpropagation came a few years after that. So this is basically taking what we had done back then and just scaling it up.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
Creating more units. We went back then, we had tiny networks with a few hundred units, a few thousand connections, one layer of hidden units. And now we have millions of units, you know, hundreds of millions of connections. So in the brain, there is 12 layers in the hierarchy in the visual system, but now people have 100 layers in some of the speech recognition networks. I mean, this is really amping up what we had done by, you know, a million times. So I thought that, gee, you know, they don't seem to understand the history here. They think that it was all created, you know, full-blown 5 years ago at a NIPS meeting. And so so that was part of my motivation. But the real motivation was I started reading articles in the newspaper about how, oh, my God, this AI is going to put people out of work.
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to replace humans. You know, we're going to become obsolete. Yeah, this is all crazy. I mean, this is not what's going to happen, and you know, the public is getting hoodwinked by people, extremists.
That's a good subtitle for the book, maybe. The public is getting hoodwinked. That's good.
Well, that could a lot of books could go under that heading.
yeah.
But this is another thing. I said, well, look, they should have access to something that is more sensible. By the way, there is the other extreme, which is the people who said, oh, this is utopia. You know, we're going to be able to solve all the problems, and, you know, humans are going to have this incredible new life that they won't have to do any hard work, and everything will be beautiful, and the medical diagnosis will happen automatically, and blah, blah. You know, those are the two extremes that people seem to gravitate toward, and neither of them is the reality. So here's an example of why that isn't. The reason is that humans just cannot imagine the impact that a new technology will have. And I'll give you an example. So back in the 1990s, when the internet went from a way for academics to exchange information, which was, you know, it used to be called ARPANET back when I was at my first job at Johns Hopkins. But when it went commercial, suddenly, you know, you had web browsers, companies went online, started selling things. You know, Amazon, you know, was just a fledgling back then. Could anybody have imagined the impact that the internet was going to have on everybody's life today, you know, 30 years later? And the reality is nobody could. You know, it's affected everything, every aspect of life. You know, music, commerce, taxis. You know, social media, politics. It's astonishing how and nobody, you know, no science fiction writer, I think, it was imaginative enough to figure this out. So I think that we're in a similar position here. Okay, we have a mechanism now that can amplify human cognition in the same way back 250 years ago in the Industrial Revolution, we created machines that can amplify physical power so that, you know, one, you know, with a tractor, one human can plow 100 times more field than a single human with a horse, right?
Yeah.
Now it's going to be the case that a single human is going to have much more impact through these, I call them cognitive appliances, right? This is not a robot that's going to go around, you know, replacing you. This is basically a way to amplify what you can do. And how smart you can be. So the mantra in the book is AI will make you smarter.
Ah, very good. So you're obviously passionate about it. You can kind of, I skimmed like the table of contents, and you can read some of the stuff when you look at the book online. And I came across that you had written the first draft of it within just a couple weeks. Is that right?
Well, you know, this was an epiphany I had. I like to go hiking every year with friends to different parts of the world. And I just came back from Norway in end of September, which was a fantastic Lofoten, which are islands off the northwest coast of Norway, just fjords coming up from the ocean. It's just spectacular. But I was hiking again in the fall in the Pacific Northwest in the Olympics. And, you know, a couple of weeks clears your mind. And you really begin to sort of feel, you start thinking about the past and you start thinking about the future. And I realized that, gee, you know, I have a story to tell. And I started, you know, just in my mind, you know, putting together some chapters. And I said, hey, this could be fun. And so when I got back, you know, I had a lot of energy because after a couple of weeks of hiking, you're in good physical shape and your mind is clear. So I just said, I'm just going to sit down and I'm just going to start writing. And literally in 2 weeks, I had a first draft. But
wow.
Now it's a completely different book from the one that I have now. But already I could see how it was going to play out. It was going to have three parts. The first part was about the past. You know, this is artificial intelligent past.
Yep.
And the middle is going to be artificial intelligence today. And the third part is going to be artificial intelligence in the future. Right? Kind of, you know, this is the Christmas story.
But yeah.
It's
yeah.
For artificial intelligence. And
it's also the classic three-act play, you know, three-act
And
structure.
That's the three-act play. There you go. Exactly right. In fact, as I started writing it, I found a voice which was very comfortable for me, which was basically, it's as if I was a personal narrative. It was, I'm there. I mean, I try to write it in such a way that a reader could put themselves there at that in the 1980s. What was it like?
Yeah, yeah.
What was going on in the world, and you know, who was getting all of the publicity, or who was working together, and how do they interact? And these are my friends, right? So I read about it the way I saw it, and I think that really put a different character. It's not a book that's meant for the experts. It's a book that's meant for a general audience. I think experts can get a lot out of it too, because of the fact that there's a lot of technical stuff in it. But I don't. That's not the heart of it. The heart of it is a personal story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about science. How does science engineering, how is it done? And, you know, it to the public, you know, they have this, what's the image of science? Well, there's a mad scientist, right? There's some genius, you know, the Einstein. I mean, it's all distorted. I mean, those are extreme metaphors for what's really going on. You know, science is put together by humans, just like everybody. And, you know, we have, brilliant scientists, and we have plotters, and we have people who are really good at writing textbooks. And so it's the whole range. You need them all. But the creative part of science is ultimately it's a group activity. It's not like you have one genius who creates it and everybody follows it, right? That's not my experience. And I think that is very rare. Occasionally it might happen, like with Einstein, but I think that the traditional scientific enterprise is won by human beings with the same strengths and weaknesses of all human beings everywhere. But somehow we manage to come together in teams, and this is the key. It's a social enterprise. What we're doing is through interactions with each other, sharing ideas, helping each other. That's how things, breakthroughs are made. And that's what happened back in the 80s.
Yeah, I was surprised, actually. I was recently reading Stephen Johnson's book, Where Good Ideas Come From. And he talked about some studies that were done in labs about how innovations take place. And the highest rate of innovation essentially took place during lab meetings, where everyone's sharing ideas across the table, which was a little surprising to me.
Isn't that interesting? You know, that's my experience, too. I had no idea that he wrote about it. And why is that? Well, here's the reason. My perspective is that it's like you're having a dialogue with a single collective of minds that are all focusing on a problem. And they have to actually. This is the other thing. This comes across. There was another study. It was done on creativity in industry, and in order for this to happen, this kind of groupthink, there has to be trust.
Mm.
In other words, someone has to be willing to say what they think, even though it may sound crazy, or they can't be afraid that people are going to laugh at them. Right. When you come up with a new idea, it's right. always the case that it's not what anybody else thought of. So therefore, people are likely to, you know, who don't know you might laugh at it, or, you know, it's poo-poo it, because, you know, a lot of it's hard to be open like that. And so I think that the idea of a lab meeting is that you have a lab that is working together and they trust each other. And if they don't, then you don't have a good lab.
Yeah. Good. So I've watched you on a talk. You've expressed how great it is right now that we have two things simultaneously going on. We have the massive success in deep networks, in AI, and we have these new powerful tools being developed in neuroscience. In your estimation, is this the most exciting time to be studying how brains work?
Not only is it an exciting time, but I think that many years from now, this era that we're living through right now will be seen as the golden era.
Mm-hmm.
The golden era when we, for the first time, had the tools that we needed to make progress. And, you know, I'm not sure how we still haven't scratched the surface of the complexity of the brain.
Right,
but I think,
right.
though, that we have, at least we now have enough tools. And by tools, I mean not just electrodes and optical recording, but analytical algorithms that allow us to analyze the big data that's being generated. Now, here's something that is a little of an interesting feedback loop here. So, you know, NIPS, Neural Information Processing System, was really born out of the neural network explosion that took place in the 80s, and I've already alluded to the learning algorithms that we developed back then.
Yeah.
And we didn't know it, but what we were really doing was creating a whole new field of machine learning. That is to say, in statistics at the time, the way that you made progress was by working with very tiny models with a few parameters and proving theorems about when it converged, you know, some system for fitting the data. Well, we were naive, you know, we're talking about, you know, let's try to understand how the brain with 100 billion neurons, right? Talk about, you know, and 10 to the 15 parameters, right? How are you going to deal with that amount of complexity?
Hey, it's only 84 billion neurons. Come on.
I think when I say 100, I mean, you know, plus or minus, you know, 20%. Nobody has actually counted every neuron. And actually, I get into arguments with my students about this. And actually, the number varies with the size of your brain. So some people have bigger brains, some people have a smaller brain. So, you know, this is not a single number. But in any case, here we are. And so who came to NIPS? And this is really fascinating. Those first few years, we only had, you know, 300-400 people show up, but they were people coming from areas that, you know, had never interacted before. I mean, we're talking about, you know, physicists, neuroscientists, cognitive scientists, mathematicians, computer vision people, speech recognition people, natural language people. And what was common to all of them was that they were trying to tackle really difficult problems, very high-dimensional problems, and they weren't making much progress with the traditional tools that were available to them in statistics. You know, I remember in that era, we basically, you know, the experts kept telling us that we were wasting our time. Why? Well, number one, we don't have enough data. If you want to develop a statistical analysis, a tool that is going to learn from data, then, you know, you only have 100 images, right? So how are you going to constrain, you know, you're overfit with your network that has, you know, 100,000 connections parameters. And then the optimization experts, you know, what they told us was that, oh, forget it. If you're crazy, you're going to get caught in local minima. Everybody knows that you have to have convex optimization function, and otherwise, you know, you're toast. Well, you know, we were naive. We were young. We went ahead anyway, and we just ran it, and it worked. You know, we didn't understand why it worked. We now know now that the reason is that when you're dealing with these high-dimensional spaces, it looks very different than a 1 or 2 or 3D space where you have mountain valleys and local minima. If you're in a million-dimensional space, they're all saddles. You know, you have a half a million going up, and you have a half a million going down, so you always have an escape route.
Mm.
Right. And so no one understood this back then because no one had really tackled high dimensional problems before. And interestingly, a couple of people from statistics did. Leo Bryman was one on our board of trustees very early on. And he was, you know, an expert on trying to tackle these problems. But he was in the minority back then. And I really appreciated him very much because he gave us, you know, a real perspective that, you know, what we're trying to do wasn't completely crazy. You know? And he felt, it's really interesting. He told me he felt more affinity with the NIPS group than with his own affinity group in statistics. You know, he really understood what we're trying to do. But, you know, back then we just couldn't scale it up. Computers were really slow by today's standards. And so the real discovery that was made 5 years ago, and this is something nobody I think could have predicted 30 years ago, is that of all the algorithms in AI, this is the only one that has scaled, that's by a factor of a million.
Yeah.
You know, typical AI algorithm is combinatoric, which means that it blows up exponentially at some point and means you have a ceiling. But if you have an algorithm like Backprop, which is linear in the parameters, basically it just scales beautifully. And you know, the more, and it's all parallelized, so it goes beautifully on a GPU's. And here's the real reason. Okay, the scaling and because of the fact that this the architecture, once you've tuned it up and once you have optimized it, which is what Jan LeCun did with convolutional neural networks over the period of, you know, 20 years, the very same architecture could be applied to many problems.
Right.
You don't have to be a domain expert. And so that means that if you have something that works for speech, you know, you could, you know, you have to adapt it, but it can be used for natural language processing. It could be used for object recognition images, captioning images. All these difficult problems in AI could be attacked if you have enough data. And that we're living in an era of big data. And that's really where I think everything comes together. And that's why kind of it was a convergence. And now to go back to your other comment, okay, just to finish the loop back, isn't it ironic today that neuroscientists are now using the machine learning algorithms that we developed in NIPS over the last 30 years? And not just deep learning, by the way. They're using it now, a few labs, but, you know, the support vector machines, which is really hot in the 90s, is now being used routinely by brain imaging people, right? I mean, that's how they decode their brain data. And so all of these algorithms that were developed in the machine learning community are now helping neuroscientists understand the brain that were originally inspired by the brain. So this is kind of a really, I kind of find it really, you're back.
You're back as well. Sorry.
I think we had a dropout.
Yeah, we did. Sorry, we got cut off there. But so I was going to say that, yeah, we were talking about this loop, the irony of the beautiful loop of, you know, the machine learning tools being used in neuroscience now. So, I mean, deep learning has had huge successes and in all these different fields, like you say, but lately it's gotten kind of some backlash, some criticism, because it's seemed to be such a small part of what we will eventually need to achieve general AI. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on general AI and getting there and the role of deep learning in that.
Right. So let's put things in perspective. And I have a chapter on this, by the way.
Oh, good.
If you take the biggest deep learning network today, it would fit into a cubic millimeter of cortex. Okay. So, and each deep learning network is a domain expert in one problem. So it's very narrow. It's called narrow AI. But the beauty is, though, that in the brain, which has, you know, hundreds of thousands of such deep learning networks in it, you have to create a system. It's another higher level of organization, which is in the computer is called an operating system, right? The operating system has to keep track of all the subroutines that are going on, daemons and scheduling, and you know, it's an interface between the applications and the hardware, and it's invisible. And what we don't know yet is what is the operating system of the brain. And ultimately, if you want human-level intelligence, you're going to have to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, I think what will evolve in the world of AI is that all of these, you know, successes, which are very narrow, are going to eventually have to be integrated together into a broader system that is able to handle routing of information, decision-making. And that's beginning to happen, by the way. So, for example, in AlphaGo, in addition to deep learning networks, there was also a basal ganglia, that is to say, a reinforcement learning algorithm, temporal differences,
mm-hmm.
which was a loop with the cortex. And that's an algorithm that also goes back to the 80s, Rich Sutton, right? But we now know that dopamine neurons in vertebrate brains, and also neurons even in insect brains, you know, that do conditioning, you know, running on dopamine, are doing reward prediction error, which is the key to understanding how to develop a value function that allows you to make decisions, a sequence of decisions to reach a reward, to reach your goal. And so what I think is going to happen over the course of the next few decades is as we learn more about the brain and more learning algorithms that nature has developed, they're going to be integrated into an AI system that will become more and more autonomous and have higher capabilities. And eventually, you know, we might reach human level intelligence, but I don't think that's really necessarily the ultimate goal.
Right.
I think the ultimate goal is to understand the human brain.
Right. Yeah.
And I think AI is going to help us do that. That's the beauty. And why do I say that? Here's, I think, where NIPS is going, and it's where everybody's going. Everybody says, well, look, it's like a black box. You know, you have something that solves a problem, but you don't know how it solved it, and how can you trust it if you can't solve it? Well, my immediate response is, you know, you have a brain. You use it. Do you understand how it works? No. You know, but you trust it.
Right.
Within limits. And so that's where we are, okay? However, we can go much farther because it turns out these deep learning networks are not black boxes. They're white boxes. They're completely accessible. We have access to every connection, every parameter, every input, every activity pattern of every input, right? If we can't understand mathematically from an engineering and analytical perspective how these devices work, then we'll never understand the brain. And so what's happening now at NIPS is that we're getting the best mathematicians coming in using algebraic topology to understand the surfaces of the cost function. There are these adversarial examples that show that by just tweaking a couple of inputs, you know, by putting in small changes, you can hit a boundary. Wow, what's that telling us about the geometry? Now we're in this high-dimensional space. We're learning. This is a completely new world now that mathematicians have jumped into. And I think what will come out at the end is a theory of learning in these very high-dimensional systems, of which the brain is one of many, many systems that we know there are many learning algorithms that take you to the same place. So why not the brain? And that will give us a theory for learning in the brain.
Well, that's great. Well, I know that I'm stretching your time thin here, and I just want to say thanks for your contributions, and I appreciate your time today. Good luck and congratulations on the book. I'm excited to get my copy. I have one final question. If you had to be cryogenically frozen today,
uh-huh.
and the minimum answer here is one day, when would you want to be thawed?
Okay. I haven't thought about that. Let me think about it. But I have to say that here's a heuristic that I've used, which is take the minimum amount of time that you would do it. And I say the minimum would be 10 years.
Oh, okay.
Take the maximum that you would be willing to live with. And let's say that's 100 years. So take the geometric mean, and that's the square root of 1,000. So we're talking about like 33 years. So that's my answer, 33 and a third years.
All right. Sinofsky's heuristic. I love it. Thank you. Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. It was a lot of fun. And I appreciate your letting me have this opportunity to be part of your podcast.
Okay. Awesome stuff. Remember, if you want to support the show, find my Patreon link on the website, braininspired.co. You can find me on Twitter as well. I am at PGMid. Next week, I'm talking with Ryota Kanai, who is working on creating artificial consciousness. So no doubt, that will be a fun conversation. Until then, thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. See you next time.